him.
Why hast thou served us thus, that thou calledest us not, when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide with him sharply. And he said unto them, What have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and what was I able to do in comparison of you? Then their anger was abated toward him when he had said that. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint yet pursuing. And he said unto the men of Succoth, Give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the princes of Succoth said, Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? And Gideon said, Therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into mine hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Then you have the people of Peniel doing the same thing. And then you have his capturing of these great kings. And verse 13, And Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle before the sun was up. Then you have these two kings with him. And verse 16, And they took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars with them. He taught the men of Succoth, and he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city. Then said he unto Zeba and Zalmunna, What manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? And they answered, As thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. And he said, They were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. Then you have him killing those two kings. Now verse 22. Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. And Gideon said unto them, I would desire a request of you that ye would give me every man the earrings of his prey. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, We will willingly give them. Now look at verse 27. And Gideon made an ephod thereof and put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither a whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. Now look at verse 30. And Gideon had 70 sons of his body begotten, for he had many wives. And his concubine that was in Shechem, she also bare him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. That will do for our reading. We tried in the meeting yesterday evening to show how the Lord in his might and power could work as well in the days of the judges as he did in the times of Joshua. And that Gideon was able to experience in his own time the same power that Joshua experienced in the defeat of the city of Jericho. That is, both alike blew trumpets, and both alike saw the mighty hand of the Lord. Now tonight we are going to look at what we might call the outcome of victory, or those tests that often follow a time of the Lord's blessing and working in power. Every one of us know right well that following times of victory can become very testing. And many of us perhaps have made our biggest blunders just after success attended our hand. That's humiliating, but that's true. Very few know anything of real blessing, but are accustomed to realize that it's likely to be
followed by a time of severe test.
You remember Abraham coming back from the slaughter of the kings. And you remember the test that came his way, even over the spoil. And that would indicate to me that very early in our Bibles, great movements of God's power can oftentimes bring in their train and in their succession, as it were, times of great testing for the instrument used. Humanity is such that very little is needful to bring out our weaknesses. And most of our experiences disclose weaknesses within us that we would hardly assume were present. When we look at this chapter, of course, in that light, there are many precious lessons to be learned from. Before ever the battle was over, Gideon got into trouble. The man that you would say had least need for it, and the man that would be least expected to have to endure it, was right up against him. And it arose from a quarter very near and dear to him. Because it arose from the other part of the same tribe as his own. Now you know that this man was of the tribe of Manasseh. And you equally know that the tribe of Ephraim, were these two tribes, were descended from Joseph. And yet the tribe of Ephraim is giving him his first trial, even before he has the kings of Midian slain. And what's wrong with them? They say, now how is it? When you went out in this wonderful time of victory, he didn't call us to help you in the battle. And I took the trouble to show you that in the 7th chapter, he had deliberately sent messengers right to their very door to tell them to come to the River Jordan. Now you equally know that he never needed them when he was blowing the trumpet. For even though he had a large army assembled to him, he had to send them home. And if he had brought more of Ephraim to him, he would have simply had to send them home too. For all the Lord allowed him to go into battle with were 300 men. So that they were needed then. But there was a time when they were needed. And when Gideon knew that they were needed, he sent messengers to them to come down to the River Jordan and meet the enemy and fight with them then. And they're all together offended because they weren't in the front rank. I wonder if he had been beaten, would they have been so anxious to be at the front rank? I wonder if his whole experience had proved a failure, would they have been so quick at complaining? But now that he has won the victory, and now that he has achieved success, they seem to envy him. They seem to think, well, you know, we're the big tribe, and we have the big numbers, and we ought to be in the forefront, and you should have given us all the counsel and advice and told us all the secrets. We should have known everything. They never seemed to think that there were 7 years the Midianites had oppressed them, and they never made a move. They didn't seem to imagine that they could have been doing big things for God just as well as Gideon could have done them. But all the time, there's that awful spirit of contention. And their words were sharp. Their words were sharp. Sometimes I wonder when I read this that Gideon didn't take his cup and give him a clip on the ear and say, away about your business, you're not worth talking to. But he didn't do that. He knew better than that. And he has here left on record a little experience that would be a boon to many of us in the things of God. What was that? He knew how to turn away wrath. He knew how to deal with upper people. He knew how to deal with angry people. You know, it's not every man can handle angry people. And there are people, when they meet angry people, that make them more angry. And they don't seem to know how to work with a man that is high-spirited and is a bit haughty. Oh, says Ephraim, says Gideon, you know, you men have done far more than me. Sure, you slew the two princes.
from the vintage, the harvest that I have gathered. What does he do? He thinks himself. And he lifts them up. And by doing that, he turns away their wrath. You know, there are lots of people, now you just give them that wee clap on the back. You know, you can get them nearly to every damn it. Wee bit of breeze, you know, goes a long way with these type of people that are easily that flare up easily. The wee bit of breeze just cools them down and leaves them thinking they're really it. And that's all they wanted to think from the start. I remember saying a brother saying to me one night after a fairly solemn discussion. It was at the end of ministry meetings and he was feeling the ministry pretty sore. So see, brother, there are two men in this meeting. And if I give them enough wind, I could get them to do anything. Now, I don't think that's fair enough. We ought to be better men than that. You know, there are men. And it doesn't take much to lift them up. And sometimes it doesn't take much to knock them down. Now, in this passage, there's a great line of truth started that will go on through the books of Kings. Now, I'm not going to develop it for you. But if you're interested in your Bible, you keep the tribe of Ephraim before your mind and go through the scriptures and see how that even in a page or two over, they're still at the same difficulty. And then when it comes to the days of David, they were just acting the same. And it never finished until there was the great divide and the tribe of Joseph separated from the tribe of Judah. Look, see, dear souls, I would want to tell us all tonight, and the speakers in fact, try and watch that you don't allow self-importance to divide the people of God. Now, will you carefully listen to that? Don't allow your own opinion of yourself to end up with a division among God's people. Here's a thing. Now you know right well that the birthright fell on Joseph, and that the tribe, Joseph had two tribes, as it were, from one. You know that. And Ephraim seemed to think that no matter who is up, we should be on top. And yet it equally is made clear in the Bible that it was the tribe of Judah that was to rule, and that the ruler was come from that tribe and not from the haughty tribe of Ephraim. So you can't produce rulers from self-important men. Now that's solemn, isn't it? You can't produce rulers from self-important men. It must be a humble-minded man that takes the lead. Now this will give me a little point that I wanted to mention maybe throughout our ponderings in the book of Judges. And it's this, that maybe you didn't notice it, but there are two great matters that don't arise in the book that you would expect to arise in it. And what is that? That, apart from the very early chapters that we dealt with at the first night of our meeting, and perhaps the first judge, there's not one judge rises out of the tribe of Judah throughout the whole book. And now apart from that at the start. And that's a big point, isn't it? That the tribe that was meant to be the ruling tribe in Israel, the tribe of Judah, never produced a judge. Now that is why the book of Ruth comes in after the book of Judges, to get us back onto the right line again and get us into the tribe of Judah. Because it's from Judah and from David that the king and the kingdom will continue. Now, you clear on that? So that the book of Ruth is a necessary appendix to this wonderful book of Judges. But that's not the only surprise in the book. The other amazing thought in the book that you should take special note of is this, that there is an absolute absence throughout the whole book, except on one occasion again at the end of the book, of a reference to the priesthood. Is that not strange? You wonder, was there a priesthood at all? As you read through this book, there's no mention of the tabernacle, except the one chapter, you know, later on, at the very end of the book, we'll never see that. But there's no reference in all these different judges that arose. There's not a reference to the priest coming in, the ritual of the tabernacle, the whole experience around the sanctuary is outside the pale of the recording of priesthood. And the tribe of Judah are notable absentees in this particular book. Now we come to Gideon's second difficulty. He's still pursuing the enemy. Now he's not going to give in. You know, a good many of us make the blunder that when the enemy's being routed, we don't go the whole length and finish the task. But he went on, right over the River Jordan, right on did he go until he reached the two kings and eventually slew them, as we saw in our reading. Now, when he's in this pursuit, he calls up two towns, Succoth and Penuel. And what do you want? He says, give me loaves of bread. Why? The army's failed. What pursuing? That is, here were places that were given a golden opportunity to help all the man that was defeating their foe and to encourage him in the battle. Now he didn't ask them to go out to fight. He didn't ask them to risk their lives. He didn't ask them in any way to annoy themselves or empty their homes or leave their tents or anything like that. Well, he says, now you give the army 300 men, give them some bread. They could do with their breakfast before they go on further with the fight. Huh? Says they. You're pursuing two kings. They're not in your hand yet. You haven't got them yet. And as far as they were concerned, they would never get them, for they wouldn't help them to get them. Well, says Gideon, when I come back with those two kings, I'll teach you another lesson. Goes to the next city, the next place, Penuel, and he asks them for the same, but they just treat him the same way. They taunt him. They taunt them and taunt them as if you're not able to do it. Now, any of you men that are given to meditation in the scriptures, you would easily see in that a little picture of the cross, wouldn't you? You remember they said to Christ, if thou be the Son of God, come down, and we will believe on thee. And you remember that they underestimated the deliverer of the nation. And they wanted him to save them from the Roman power. And they seemed to see nothing in him but helplessness. But when Gideon come back, he taught them another lesson. And when our blessed Lord comes back, he will teach the nation another lesson. I think anyone can see that in the story lying on the surface of it. Now he goes on after these kings. And he overtakes them. Finds that they, like himself, were resting away, as they thought, in the place of safety. And he surrounds their camp, and he takes the two of them prisoner. And he brings them back, and he says now to the people of Succoth and the people of Penuel, there they are now, they're in the hand this time. If you doubt it, my power the last time, you can't doubt it this time. I have proof positive that the Lord was with me, and that the Lord has slain them, and that blood is wrought, and that the victory is mine. You know, there are types of people, and you've always to remember that they will not take anything by promise. It must be, I was going to use the homely expression, a bird in the hand worth two in the bush. They'll have no confidence in anything unless there it is. There it is. Mind you, there's no argument against that. No argument against that. Here's a man fighting the Lord's battles, but he has left before the face of his highest critics a proof that the Lord is with him. He has silenced them without it on the Lord's power. Now you know that both Peter and Paul were oftentimes confronted with great criticism in their service for the Lord. You remember Peter had to meet what we nearly call an oversight meeting because he went into the house of Cornelius. And you remember how he met his critics on that occasion and showed them, well now, if I have gone there, God granted me an experience in the house of Cornelius, parallel and similar to what happened on the day of Pentecost. And if God was pleased to set a seal of approval upon us,
what right has any man to question?
And you will recall that Paul did the very same thing, that he could bring out of the Gentile nations somewhat that couldn't be questioned of the mighty power of God in the gospel, so that they could no longer doubt what God was with them in his service.
You know, we need that. We need that. Now, I'm not saying that a man always accomplishes what he sets out to do. I'm not saying that the man preaching the gospel is always seeing fruit in his work. I'm not saying that a man who goes to the mission field will find the going easy. But every man in the work of God should, at given time, leave his samples down before the greatest critics that ever were raised in the world. So there's the evidence. Ye are our epistles, said Paul to the Corinthians. Know the real old man. Orders me paper and pen to write. But he says, as far as you're concerned, there's an evidence far more permanent than any letter men may write and sign with all sincerity. He brought the proof of his power in fellowship with God to the face of those people. And he carried out his chastening and threatenings upon them. And the two cities suffered heavily because they were not prepared to help the man in the fight. You know, there are many men, and you'll never be asked to go to the mission field. You never sleep away from home for the sake of the gospel. You never stand any abuse at anybody's door by telling the story of Christ in their face. You never have that to do. Hope you don't eat the bread off them. You know that a man could sit at the Lord's table and wouldn't drop a penny in a box. That's not right. That's not right. That's keeping back the loaves. Oh, you say, but that's not it. That's all right. I'm not a man looking at anything. Don't misunderstand us. That's not the point. Gideon came to men, and he needed their supper. He didn't ask them for her to take any risks. They could have given him all that he needed without even feeling the want of it. But they wouldn't do it. And I've never known a Christian that has refused to help the work of God, but was the poorer as the result. And I've never known an assembly that tried to hinder the work of God and the servants of God that ever prospered. And we want to watch that. Because remember, God's no man's debtor. Every man would stand that knows he's God and give testimony to that. He's no man's debtor. You never could give anything to God. He'll beat you every time if I ever use that phrase. You know it too well. The more you try to give him, the more he'll put back. The more you bring into his service, the more he would bless you. The more you try to sacrifice for him, the more he would honor you. You can't ever put God in your debt. But on the other hand, then there's that refusal to have all that which is of God. Then the trouble is that we are the losers for taking up that attitude. Moving on now. These two kings were interrogated. And Gideon remembers that they had been guilty of slaughter. They had slain his brethren. And he asked them, now, what did the men resemble? Or what were they like, the men you slew? And they said, they were just like you, Gideon. They, everyone, resembled the son of a king. Ah, says Gideon, those are my brethren. Those are my brethren. Every one of you, of course, when you're reading that, you link that over with Matthew 25, and you're all right in that. For as much as you did it unto one of the least of my brethren, you did it unto me. That is, Gideon shows the link between himself and the men that were slain. And he says, they're sons of my mother.
They were dear to his heart, and there were the man in his hand that had slain him. And he rose up, but his son refused to do it, and he slew these two kings. I suppose if I was prophetically minded in these meetings, I would see those two kings very much like the other two that will be put to the lake of fire by Christ himself when he comes back again. Caught red-handed in the book of Revelation, those two beasts, the great ruler of the Roman Empire, or the revived Roman Empire, and the Antichrist, both consigned to the lake of fire by Christ at his coming. Little shadows of these things come into the picture here. And certainly those who have ill-treated his brethren, according to the gospel that I've quoted, these shall go away into everlasting punishment, and the righteous into life eternal. Now that brings us to another thought. And when all this battle's over, not a millionite left. Remarkable, isn't it? There wasn't one of 300 killed. Though they were fighting one man against 450, there wasn't one of them killed. And though they were faint and preserved, you'd think they'd be easy knocked out when they're faint, but they were all preserved. And they were all kept alive. And now they're back and the battle's over. And the whole experience of the struggle with the Midianites has come to an end. And what happens now? They say to Gideon, now Gideon, will you be our king? Now don't forget, he's of the tribe of Manasseh. He's not in the royal line. And here's a temptation, you see that word come into any man's heart. Should I now not be king? Oh no, says Gideon, the Lord will be your king. I'm not but that. I go home to my house. You know, it's not easy being humble before we start doing exploits for God. But it's not so easy being humble when the exploits are over and we have succeeded. Success is a most difficult thing for a man to bear. And here's a man that's had success. And they say, now we'll make a king. Here would have been the first monarch to reign in Israel. And he might have well said, well, you know, I have a right to do it, because, mind you, I'm telling you, if it hadn't been for me, you'd have been feeding the Midianites instead of feeding themselves. If it hadn't been for me, the country would all have been in poverty. I'm telling you, the nation owes me a debt. And they owe me something that the words could never tell. And I lost sleep over them, and I threw God in them. I am among them, and I have found now, and I ought to be made somebody of some account. And we'll make him king. No, says Gideon, no. 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 He has a knowledge that that's a position he never was meant to occupy. He has refused a position that God never intended him to be in. Mind you, it's not so easy doing that. It's not so easy. Nice to see a man able to go to his old home. You know, the same is said about David later on when he slew the giant. That he went back to his father's sheep. And he would have just as gladly gone home if Saul had let him stay there. You see, there was that spirit of humility in him. That he wasn't elated. You see, every time he speaks of the victory, he has always the thought that God gave the victory. It was the Lord, the Spirit, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. He could always see it's the Lord's doing. Oh, we would only get that into our minds. Not unto us. But unto thee be glory should ever be before our souls. But then, we come to a rather sad side of his story. This, to me, is most trying, most searching. Because a man can triumph so often and yet go down to finish. That makes me feel very sore when I'm reading over these verses. And what's he do now? He says, now I desire one thing from you. Hope you watch that now. It says, desire now. What do you want? Get it. What do you want? We want you to give us the spoil, the earrings, the golden earrings that you took away from the enemy as you slew them. And we want you to give us the chains of gold that would be on their animals, on their camels. Those decorations on the horses, or on the camels. And I want you to give us just that spoil. They did a very simple thing. They just spread a large garment on the ground.
and they started to throw in their ears. Until thousands of pounds worth of gold was collected in that collecting vessel, as it were, the garment. Now, what are you going to do with this? No, there's something strange. He's going to have an ephod made of it. That is, he's refused the kingship. But he's coming very close to claiming priesthood. Because he's going to wear an ephod. He's going to have an ephod. And he's going to put into it likely something akin to what was on the wonderful ephod of Aaron. No, I'm not saying he accomplished all that was in Aaron's ephod, but he's at least making something very like it. He maybe wants to have some instrument that will give him guidance on the movements that he's to make or the steps he's to take. I'm not sure what his motive was, but he made this thing. And he's made it as a kind of a monument for the great victory he has won that will keep it in memory for many days. And he has all that made until the Israelites turn it into an idol. And they go a-whoring after it. They turn the ephod into an idol. Now, of course, I don't need to tell you folk that there's a slight resemblance between this and what Aaron did when he made the golden calf. Isn't it very much like what he did when he said, well now, break off your earrings. And he put in the gold and it came out a calf. So he said, but the Bible's more accurate, he fashioned it with an engraving tool. He would more or less just imagine that you throw gold into a fire, it comes out a calf. Might have come out a lion if he hadn't have put his hand on it. And it certainly come out a shapeless mass if he hadn't have worked at it. And that, of course, was a great snare in Israel. Because there was a link in it with the God of Israel. You see the great subtlety of the calf that Aaron made and the calves of Jeroboam later on made in the land. And this ephod that's made here is this. That is a mixing of what's of the Lord with what's of idolatry. You see, Jeroboam knew right well he would have to imitate what was going on in Jerusalem, otherwise the nation wouldn't fall for it. So he ordained a feast like unto the one of Jerusalem. And he organized his great days in a different time of the year, doubtless, so that they could go to both, you know. And he had things organized in that way. Now here there's an imitation. An imitation produced by Gideon and used for a wrong purpose by the nation. For mind you, the tendency to idolatry was always high in the nation of Israel. The human heart makes an object in which it can rely as a god. Isn't that very sad? Isn't that very sad? Good brethren, a man could introduce something into amongst God's people that he himself never thought would be serious or very bad, that could have serious consequences. Always watch, dear brethren, that you don't be the instrument to introduce among God's people something that's foreign to a scriptural assembly. Now you watch that. Oh, but you say, Mr. Gay, you're far too extreme. You're far too extreme. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with ephod? Didn't Aaron wear one? Didn't God give him the pattern of one? Well, that's all right. But God never told Gideon to get one made. And God never meant even Aaron's ephod to be an object of worship any more than Gideon's to be. You see, dear soul, many a thing is introduced into the assembly on the plea, well, what's wrong with it? The question we ought to ask is, what scripture have we for it? What's in the Bible to encourage us in it? And if there's nothing in the Bible to encourage us in it, we might well, in wisdom and humility, well say to ourselves before God, you know, there must be something dreadful about it, and I'd better leave it alone. It's not such a big distance between what is non-scriptural and what is unscriptural. The one very quickly would lead into the other. It may begin with non-scripture, but would very soon drift into unscripture. And that is often times have. People say, well, you know, it wasn't me that started. And the man that started never thought it would end up like this. Never dreamt it would go so far. He was a good man. He was a sincere man. He was a man that sacrificed much for the assembly. But even a good man, and even a sincere man, and even a man with God working along with him, even a man like that introduces something that's going to turn aside the steps. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. Then there's another point mentioned. Just mentioned there. And that is this, that he had 77 sons, or something like that. And he had many wives. And then he had a concubine. And then he had an Abimelech born of that concubine. Now ponder this over. What is all that telling us? Now, I don't want anybody to go home from the meeting and say that a man who had more than one wife in the Old Testament was living a corrupt life. I wouldn't preach that, for that wouldn't be right. Polygamy was tolerated in the Old Testament. It never was encouraged, but was tolerated. And you mustn't put more into the Bible than's in it. Now, be careful. But mind you, I think I would be modest when I would say that Gideon shows a tendency along certain lines that would indicate to me an indulgence in the flesh, no matter what way you were in. Now I want you to go back over those three things that we mentioned. He desired of them the gold of the earrings. He made an ephod, and he had many wives. Now, if you look at those three points that I've raised, you'll find that they cover three major points that we often stress in our public meetings. In the first, we have something soulish. We have desire. That's the soul. In the second, we have him making an ephod. That has to do with religion. That's the spiritual side of the man. That's weak. And in those wives, we cannot deny, but it's the flesh that's operative. Have you caught the point? That here's a man failing in soul, failing in spirit, and failing in the flesh. That threefold way in which we're all tested. What about our desires tonight? Would you be desiring something, friend? Many a man has desired the gold. Many a one has desired something. Wonder if our desires tonight were spread out in public, what kind of a meeting would we have? Is your soul right? Now the soul is the seat of desire. Is your soul right? Would you have a hankering after something that would grieve the Lord if even you got it? That you would misuse it? Is your soul after anything that's grieving to the Lord? Is there something that has become an object that you would long to possess? Now, I don't need to remind you of Genesis 3. A tree to be desired. The soul operates. Then the spirit is going to say, the judging faculty, bringing into existence something that God never intended to exist, of a religious character. His spirit is going astray. Now I know he was limited in the wrong that he did in connection with ephod. But he made an object that brought disaster to the weaker minds and to those who knew less than himself. We've always to remember, dear brethren, that we not only have to keep ourselves right, but to watch our conduct that it won't encourage those that are less instructed than ourselves to do something that would grieve the Lord. for they'll likely go much further than ever we went. You know, the overseers have introduced things into God's assembly, and the next generation carried them much further than they ever intended them to go. Right, well, you know that. And men have started things, and they have been a grief to the saints for years, and they'll likely go on after their day. Now, what about the flesh? That indulgence of mere human nature. No breaks on. No self-control. No realization of the limitations that God intended. I'm sure when he read the story of Genesis chapter 2, he must have felt rebuked. That wasn't the way he was living. He's gone away from the heavenly. God didn't make three or four wives for Adam. Just made him one. He didn't even let him select her. He gave her to him. God made one at the beginning. That was the headline. I wonder how he fits in with the headline. No, it's not according to him. There's something going astray here. His 77 sons or whatever the number may be. And then this concubine, just not even a wife, tells a sad tale. Would it not make your heart sore to think that the man who could lift the trumpet, who could see the enemy routed, who could know how to behave himself with the different folks that came into his way, that when it came to his latter life, the latter part of his life, he seems to have missed out in these three respects. You know, dear soul, it often humbles us, doesn't it? Does it not oftentimes make us tremble, especially when we cross the halfway line of life, lest the latter part of the life begins to have shadows on it, begins to become clouded a bit, and we go down, as it were, instead of shining more and more until the perfect day. Gideon, I say, left behind him the seeds of trouble that his own family had to bear. For you know, he had a sad life in Wales. His whole brothers evidently were killed by these Midianitish kings. He lost his family that way. And now his whole sons, those boys that he had reared, they're everyone put to death. And the instrument that put them to death was one that was born to Gideon by a concubine. Now, I'm not putting anything into the story, but you can read it for yourself now. In other words, by giving himself unreasonable license along certain lines, he was bringing about the ruin of his own house and leaving a harvest of trouble when the earthly journey for himself was over. I wonder how we will leave the world. I wonder how we'll leave God's assemblies. Some of us won't be very long here. The indications are that our lives are coming near an end. Will we leave the assembly happier than we found it? Will we leave the assembly with some sort of a canker in it that will never be healed for years after we're gone? Will we have started something that's a source of trouble to God's people and will be till the day we die? Or will we have introduced anything amongst God's saints that would be a grief to their souls and a disaster in times to come? Now, what would we say in the light of this? Could we not all quote the psalm tonight in all humanity? Preserve me, O God. Preserve me. The man that could beat the Midianites was beaten by himself. Who was to blame for asking for the goat? Couldn't blame the Ephraimites. He couldn't blame the men of Sodom. He couldn't blame the Midianites. Who was to blame for that? Just himself. Who was to blame for making the ephod? He couldn't say those 300 men that I took with me, you know, you couldn't keep them right unless you just did what they told. There wasn't a man amongst them said make an ephod. Who was it introduced all those women into his house and into his life? And took them to the concubine. He'd only himself to blame. It's humbling, isn't it? May the Lord help us to learn the lesson, shall we pray?